Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, hello, and welcome to Feed Your Head. Tonight we have Carl Davidson from the Online University of the Left. You can find that at oulefc.org. Hello, Carl.
Well, thanks. Thanks for having me on, Ruthann.
I'm so happy to have you here, and you have so many interests and so much knowledge. We could talk for hours, so we're going to narrow it down a little bit tonight. Could you just tell us a bit about the online university? I know you're the founder of it.
It's myself and about 50 professors and other, you know, people engaged in the intellectual world are basically the core of it. And basically what we decided is that across the internet, there's a million fascinating, interesting things that can be used to raise people's consciousness and knowledge about social change. And so what we decided to do was that, to centralize them and to pull them together in a, a reader-friendly format. So we set up the, sort of the portal that goes into it as if it were, an online university, like the University of Phoenix or any number of these other new online schools are on. It's organized in a way that has different departments and archives and interesting things, live classrooms, different things that are interesting to use, book review section, a blog section for discussion and debate. And just set it up, and then we started to add hundreds and hundreds of video classes on every subject under the sun. Some of them rather easy or introductory, a discussion on solar power, solar energy, giving an example of a new factory or something like that, to a 19-session course on African American history from Stanford University, and all sorts of things in between. So that was the basic idea, and we just started it in January, and it's starting to take off, actually. It's got something like 10,000 visits so far. 75,000 people have looked at the ads for it or looked at it itself, and we now have about 25 people who've signed up for daily updates on it. And I get a report from the web server outfit that I use, that I'm getting about 200 people a day that regularly come in and use it, but it's not the same 200, not the same 200 people every day. It's, it's a mixture. And now if I could take all those numbers and multiply them by 10, I would consider it a success. we're doing pretty good, but we're just getting started.
Well, I think so. I mean, it's still a baby since January,
right. And
you might want to add that some of these are free.
They're all free. They're all free at this point.
Aren't you going, right, but there's going to be down the road a conference called Teaching Positively,
right,
that may have a small
We may have classes in real time. In other words, you will actually be able to listen and ask questions of the presenter or the lecturer or the professor in real time through video conferencing. And
right. On
that feature, we may charge a small fee, for taking that course. But everything, 95% of the stuff on it is free.
Right. And it's just because you have strong feelings about getting this information out.
Yeah. Well, that plus, I've been working on the internet stuff for a long time, ever since, they first invented the web browser, even before then. And one thing you learn in the business is there's what's called the porn site model. You can 95% of the stuff is free, but real live action you pay a little bit for.
Okay, love it. Okay, I will remember that. Okay, so the porn model, real live action you pay for. That's Carl. Yeah, okay. I'm making a note of this, so so I can credit you.
Well, maybe that'll be a teaser to get a few people to take a look at the site.
OUTLeft.org.
Anyway, it's a labor of love, and I'm having a lot of fun with it.
Yeah. Well, you know what? I mean, nothing. It seems like you can't keep something going consistently if you don't have passion for it. And part of the passion should be, at least sometimes, even if it's a very serious topic, sometimes you've got to have fun with it.
Right.
So, otherwise, it's just not going to last at all. But now, there's all types of studies on Marx and Marxism and the left on this university, too.
Yes. I should note, though, that I made a principle of being inclusive. In other words, I put everybody up there, even people who wouldn't sit in the same room with each other.
Right.
In the archive section, you'll find the Stalin archives, the Trotsky archives, the Chairman Mao archives, the Deng Xiaoping archives, the anarchist archives. So we're very eclectic and inclusive. So there's all kinds of stuff. And some of the stuff has a kind of Marxist core to it. But some of the stuff is just, you know, generally progressive. Like in our science department, I put up Carl Sagan's Cosmos series, the whole Cosmos series, which I think is, you know, and it's not really directly political, but it is in a kind of mind-expanding way.
That's it. Almost everything is.
I think,
you know, yeah, that when you just glance, it doesn't seem political, but when you get more into it and think, well, it's not political.
Right.
I think I just read today his birthday, or would have been. Yeah, I caught some quotes about Carl Sagan. So you've got the whole
Cosmos series. You can watch the whole thing there.
Well, how did you then? But let's just talk a little bit because it has a Marxist base, sort of. Do you want to tell a little bit about your own politics?
Well. You know, I started off as just many years ago, 50 years ago, when I was one of the young rebels of the late 1950s rebels without a cause, you know. When James Dean came out with that movie, you know, I think I went and watched it 13 times. It just captured my imagination. I was a Western Pennsylvania rockabilly greaser type kid, and I was. I'm not all that political, but I was alienated, and I managed to get to the university, and I was very much into jazz music and the Beat Generation, and that caused me to cross the color line, and so then when the civil rights stuff hit, I got very much involved in it, and I went off to Mississippi for Freedom March and things like that, and that, you know, completely turned my head around and revolutionized me in many ways. And then I came back, and the Vietnam War took off. I became involved in the anti-war movement and eventually became one of the leaders of Students for Democratic Society by 1966-68. So that's where I started learning politics, there in the university. In the university, I started studying science, and then I went to the philosophy of science, then philosophy, and I studied Hegel, and then Marx. And Marx was actually, you know, even though I came through philosophy, it was actually, you know, a worldview that, you know, seemed natural to me, having grown up here in you know, the steel mills and steel valley of Western Pennsylvania, a very blue-collar reality. So Marxism was just always made, you know, made sense of the world for me, and it was always served as a kind of anchor. And Marx was a brilliant young scholar when he did most of his best work. He did good work all of his life, but I was just, you know, have sort of seen him as a role model throughout my life.
Right. So, wow. So you've just been active from the get-go.
Right. I was a rebel youth who never knew when to stop.
Okay.
I just kept at it.
And you right now you live in the area you grew up.
Yes, I kind of sort of come full circle. I when I was 18, all I wanted to do was get out of here. But then so I was ran around the country for SBS for a couple of years working for them. Then I had a job in New York City for 8 years at a radical newspaper called The Guardian. Then I lived in Chicago for 25 years where I did some writing, as well as eventually I got into computers and community technology movement. And then when it came time to retire, though, I had kept going back and visiting my family twice a year. And every time I went back, it grew on me more and more. And so when it came time to retire, it was just, you know, it's very lovely here. You know, it's quite a beautiful part of the country. And especially with all the mills shut down, unfortunately, it sort of reverted to its pristine glory in lots of ways. So anyway, my family's still here. My roots go back very deep in this part of the country. So that's where I am.
Well,
yeah, I'm right near Pittsburgh. If I feel the need for culture and jazz and the big city life, it's just, you know, 30 minutes down the road. So.
Yeah. No, I think that Pennsylvania is beautiful. It's there's a lot of it looks like low hills and things, which I've been told has to do with the former coal mining.
Right.
But it is a beautiful area, and they've been trying to frack the hell out of it.
Yeah, we're at ground zero for the frackers and crackers. That's a big concern of ours here. And that, and not too far from here, too, just a little further south, is a mountaintop removal. They're blowing off in West Virginia. They're blowing off the tops of the mountains to get at the coal and the poison in the water and all sorts of things. So, yeah, we have big battles around environmentalism is a big deal here, as well as it divides a lot of people, though, because people are also desperate for work. So it creates all sorts of very interesting problems.
Right. Yes. Well, that's a hard one, because it seems like so many of the jobs are environmentally unfriendly.
Right.
And people do need to feed their families.
Right.
And
absolutely.
That's where I think the government has got to come up with the ways and means, and people themselves, and that leads us right into co-op. How did you first become interested in workers' cooperatives?
Well, I was living in Chicago in the 1990s, and the first big wave of deindustrialization, factories shutting down and then moving to the global south, took place. My hometown here in Aliquippa, Pennsylvania, was totally devastated. We had the largest steel mill in the world here, and now it's the largest brownfield in the world. But I was living in Chicago, and plants were closing left and right, and we had a movement against plant closings. And I was involved in that, as well as in community technology, trying to set up computer learning centers in poor neighborhoods, after-school programs. And so we were battling to keep certain factories open. And the biggest one that we were engaged in was an outfit called Stuart Warner, and it had about 5,000 workers originally, and it made auto gauges, and they were just running. They were perfectly profitable. They were just running away to make more money, and so we had a huge coalition to have the workers take it over, rather than just be laid off. And so we reassembled a coalition to save Stuart Warner, we called it, and we got everybody involved, churches, the neighborhood, the community. We got a majority of the city council. We got banks, other unions. And we were just about ready. We won over the mayor finally, and we were just about ready to, you know, take it over. And at the last minute, the union pulled out.
Well,
the union said they were not in the business to run capitalism better than the capitalists. And so the whole coalition fell apart. So that was very disappointing, to say the least. But in the midst of it, I thought it was a very poor decision on the part of the union. And actually, it's the same union now 20 years later, is involved in the Republic Windows battle in Chicago, where the workers are taking over the factory and are start turning it into a cooperative. So they've learned a lesson over 20 years. But in the midst of that struggle, I had heard of, some people talk about the actual, we wanted to know, were there any living examples of where workers ran their own factories? And people said, sure, there's Mondragon in Spain. Well, I'd never heard of Mondragon, but I found an old BBC film put out in 1980 that told the story of Mondragon, which is actually, it's still a very good film. It's just a little dated. If you multiply all the numbers by three, you still get the modern story of Mondragon because the core principles are the same. But it was just an eye-opener. And so I talked to everybody who had ever been there, and we sent the group I was working with sent a few people over to Mondragon. And I met some theoreticians, socialist theoreticians who had studied it and were writing on it. And I just constantly followed it and talked about it. And then a couple of years ago, I had the opportunity to go over there on a study tour where
I went to
intensive study for a week and learned everything there is to know about it inside and out as best as we can in a short period of time. And then after I came back, I wrote a short book on it called New Paths to Socialism.
Where can we get the book?
You can just Google my name and New Paths to Socialism, and you'll find where you can get it online. And it'll pop up either from directly from the publisher or you can get it on Amazon. Just Carl Davidson and New Paths to Socialism, and you'll find ads for it. Or if you run into me at a bookstore or somewhere giving a talk, I'll sell you a copy. But I'll carry them around with you.
Well, so you were quite impressed with Mondragon then?
Yes. It's sort of the mother lode. It's been around for 50 years of modern social worker co-ops.
Right.
It's been around for 50 years, and it's constantly expanded, and it is thriving. And I like to tell people it's sort of like a platypus. You know, when they first discovered the platypus, everybody thought it was a fake or a hoax. It wasn't supposed to, according to all the conventional theory, it wasn't supposed to be there. that's sort of what Mondragon is. But like the platypus, you know, it doesn't know that it's a mistake. It just keeps on multiplying and thriving. You know, so eventually the theory's got to catch up to it. So Mondragon is now 120 co-ops, mostly centered in the Basque Country, but now all over Europe and some in China and South America. And they have a very interesting formula for success. There's really two secrets to Mondragon success. One is that there are a 3-in-1 combination of worker-owned school, worker-owned bank, and worker-owned factory. And all of them are run on the same democratic principles: one worker, one share, one vote. The second secret to their success is that if you die or you want to leave the co-op for some reason, you can cash out, but you're not allowed to sell your share.
Mm.
The only one who can buy your share is a new incoming worker. So there's no outside owners of any shares in any of the co-ops. Now, some of the co-ops own half of the shares of other institutions in the network. For instance, they have a bank that has 1.2 million depositors and 4.2 billion euros in assets. And it's, you know, one of the larger banks in Europe, Caja Laboral, it's called. And half of the shares of the bank are owned by the Mondragon worker co-ops, and the other half are owned by the workers who actually work in the bank, everybody from the tellers to the guy who sweeps the floor to the manager. They all have one chair, one vote. So same with their healthcare system. You know, half of the shares are owned by the actual healthcare workers or social service workers, and the other half of the shares are owned by the other co-ops. So
let me ask you a question on that then. where it comes to running, say, the bank or the hospital,
right,
the workers who work there that own have to share. They're the ones that vote, I assume? Or
yes.
So the ones who are holding it from other co-ops don't vote on the management?
No. They do. Anybody with a share votes on the management. So these are called second-degree co-ops, and there's just a few of them. There's the bank. There's the pension fund, the healthcare, and the Mondragon University. So it's only those where you have this sort of half-and-half relationship. All of the other 120 co-ops are one worker, one chair, one vote. And they elect their leadership. The leadership can, the managers, the governing councils, and they oversee it. And then the governing council can hire its own manager, either from within itself or from outside if they want. If they do hire somebody from outside, he has to buy into the co-op. Yes, they get a share in the co-op, like any other worker. So they have control over their management in the sense that they choose them, and they can get rid of them, and sometimes they do.
Mm-hmm.
They have big meetings either once every 6 months or once a year where they can decide very important policies like the way, pay spread, the company's strategy, what products it's going to make, and so on. And they're very serious about it. If you miss one of these meetings, you get a warning. If you miss another one, you get fined. They're very serious about it.
Okay.
They really encourage people to take part in these governing council and general assemblies. Most of the workers do because the decisions are fairly important. It's not Mickey Mouse stuff that they're deciding.
Right. Very important. And this way, people can't say, well, I wasn't there. If I'd have been there, I'd have voted this or that or whatever. It's like, no, you've got your chance. So I like that a lot.
So they make everything under the sun. They have, from auto parts to construction companies to, they make machine tools that make other parts. And some of them are fairly advanced, some of the most advanced productive forces I've ever seen. I visit one co-op there where they were all young people working at it, and they were explaining what they were making. They told us they were making solar. They weren't making solar. They showed us little solar cells, which is that we're not making solar cells. We're making the machine that makes solar cells. They says it's relatively easy to make a machine that can make one of these cells every 1.8 seconds. Hmm. But the global market wants us to make a machine that will make them perfectly every 1.2 seconds, and that's very hard. So they were, working intensely as only young people can. And
right.
I said, well, what happens if you lose? And they said, we lose millions of euros. I said, what happens if you win? They said, well, we're in the gravy, So
yeah.
I checked up 4 months after I come back, and they had won. They had managed to develop this machine that made these little solar cells every 1.2 seconds.
Well,
and you can guess who the customer was, though.
Who was it?
China.
Aha. Uh-huh. That's funny.
Now, there's no reason why the U.S. couldn't have bought it. But
Right. Because the U.S. is so enamored of the petroleum
coal
industry and on
gas.
And the
carbon.
Big money. That's disgraceful. It really is. There's no way around that. Now, for the Mondragon, I've read that there's a school, possibly like a tech school,
mm-hmm.
and that's why these people are so knowledgeable.
Well, Mondragon was started out of the devastation of the end of the Spanish Civil War and World War II.
Right. Wasn't there youth involved?
The Basque Country was part of the resistance to Franco.
Mm-hmm.
And they were devastated. The Nazis dive-bombed them. And if you've seen Picasso's Guernica, That's the painting that represents Guernica's Basque town. And the priest in the Mondragon Valley had been assassinated by Franco, and one of the priests who had fought against Franco was managed to get out of prison without getting executed, and the church sent him there. His name was Father Arizmendi, and he was the founder of Mondragon. He's a brilliant radical priest, a great or gifted organizer, and a great theoretician. And like most priests, when he arrived there, the first thing he did was to start a school. That's what priests mm-hmm. do. When they come into a parish, they set up a school. And so he went around to all the peasants and encouraged them to cough up, you know, the few pennies they had hidden away. And they started a little credit union. And out of that credit union, they funded the school. And it was a technical school, and sort of like an industrial arts high school. Community college, right. The only difference was he encouraged girls to go to it as well, which was kind of different. Once the school had graduated its first class, he took the best five students, and they got an old building donated, and he said, come up with a product. And they did. They came up with this little kerosene stove that, you know, doesn't look like very much these days. It looks more like something you would take camping. But in that time, in that place, where people had no heat in their homes and nothing to cook on except open wood fires, this was a godsend. And so it was just the right product at just the right time, and it became very successful. That little plant that made that little stove is now called Tagor, and it has 6,000 workers. And they produce refrigerators and microwaves and convection ovens, not only throughout Spain and France, but in China and around the world. And they're known for very high-quality home appliances, they high-end. Moderately priced, but high-end as far as quality goes. And so that's the history of it. And a little credit, tiny credit union, eventually became Caja Laboral, this huge bank. And the little technical school is now Mondragon University, and eight different associated research and development centers. And Mondragon University has an enrollment about 3,500, 4,000 students. It belongs, half of it is owned by the other industrial co-ops, and the other half of the shares are the faculty members and a few shares of the students. It's very much geared to training and innovation for the co-ops. That's the reason why the 3-in-1 combination is important. Is a lot of co-ops fail because they either lack access to credit or because they lack access to new ideas and innovation. And so that's why Arizmendi was very smart when he combined all three from the very beginning. In fact, he started with the school first. When we decided to follow him in Chicago, we were waging a battle on the west side of Chicago against the closing of Brock Candy, which was a huge...
I remember.
Brock Candy, it was about 5,000 workers lost their jobs over that. But anyway, after we had lost the battle, we figured one point, and I had been involved in community technology, I said, well, why don't we do what Arizmendi did? He started with the school, so let's build the perfect high-tech high school in Chicago, but we will do it not out in some boutique school in the suburbs, but we will do it in the poorest, lowest income black neighborhood in Chicago. We will build the perfect high-tech high school. It took us 3 years of planning, but we did. It's called Austin Polytechnical, and it's graduated several classes now. And it's a Chicago public school, neighborhood-based, and it's doing quite well. It has a lot of problems. This is Chicago, and it's a very poor neighborhood, and kids come in who can't read very well. The curriculum there is very demanding, so they have to go through all these extra crash courses. And so we do our best with it, but it's the progress. We sent some of the kids over to Mondragon to study, and we brought leaders of the Italian cooperatives from the Emilia-Romagna region over to talk to the students to encourage them. They're starting their own little business making, mouthpieces for musical instruments. They're partnered, the school is partnered with some 20 or 30 high-tech firms in the area, so the kids get internships and summer jobs.
Well, that's great.
And so that was our little piece of it, our approach to it was to start with Austin Polytech as, you know, being inspired by Father Esmendi's idea of starting with a school.
Wow. I wonder what he's thinking now when he got started. Not just there in Basque Country.
Oh, he's not on this. He died about 20 years ago, but
so he got to see a lot of it.
He got to see the success. He was to see the success of it. So the interesting thing that happened is here in Pennsylvania is that at one point the steelworkers and the governor at the time, Ed Rendell, and the steelworkers got together and with a Spanish outfit called Gamesa, which made state-of-the-art windmills. And they took over two old plants and reconverted them to make the wind turbines. And then they created a third plant not too far from me here where they made the blades. And this was great. And part of the deal was that Gamesa, the windmill firm, would not stand in the way of a union election. So it's 1,000 new jobs, and they're all United Steelworker jobs. So the steelworkers were thrilled, and it was win-win-win all the way around. And they went to the Gamesa guy and said, okay, this is great. What can we do next? And the Gamesa guy said, well, have you ever heard of Mondragon? No. He said, well, Gamesa's not part of Mondragon. He took off his Gamesa hat and put on his Mondragon hat. He said, I'm also the North American rep for Mondragon. So he took the steelworkers over there, and they were delighted with the place. And they signed an agreement between the largest industrial union in the U.S. and and Mondragon being the largest worker-owned co-op in the world, that they would work together to try to bring worker co-ops to the U.S. In greater numbers. And there are actually quite a few workers in the U.S. Nobody knows about them. But anyway, the steelworkers decided that, you know, the steelworkers are very big on what they call the clean energy and green manufacturing industrial revolution. They see that as the only future for their
sector. I didn't know that, and I'm really glad to hear it.
Right. So they really want to see all these new startups, and if they can't get American capitalists to do them, they are going to try to do it themselves by encouraging these Mondragon stock cooperatives to start. There's a couple started up in Cleveland now, the Evergreen Co-ops, one of which is called Ohio Cooperative Solar, which does very interesting things. They make a little miniature solar energy power plants, and they put them on the rooftops of all the big skyscrapers in downtown Cleveland. And they lease the roof. The building gets a cut on their electricity, and you know they sell the power to the grid. But the workers who Ohio Cooperative Solar retains the ownership of the actual solar arrays. It's a way that it's kind of a worker-owned power companies that's electricity from the sun, pumping it into the grid, and it can be endlessly repeated. So that's something that people are looking at too.
That's really impressive. Well, and you know,
we're talking a lot more about, other than the little store where you go buy your brown rice and incense. We're talking serious scale production here.
Okay. Yeah, well, I buy my brown rice at ethnic stores and my incense, at one of those stores. So, And in fact, I've been in since going now. I'm one of those people. But
right.
I do want to mention that we're talking with Carl Davidson, who is the national co-chair of the Committees of Correspondence for Democracy and Socialism. He's a national board member of Solidarity Economy Network and a member of the Steelworkers Association, which is why he understands so much about the steelworkers and what they've been doing. He's also the founder of the Online University of the Left, which you can find at ouleft.org. And on Facebook, you can go to Solidarity Economy and find more. So Carl is all over the place, more or less. But I know that you've said before, and we've been talking about cooperatives, and it's not been that long ago that I had read something about Mondragon, and I just became pretty much obsessed. Like, you know, I fell in love with it, and I haven't been there. But, I mean, just everything I read and I saw, it might be the old movie you were talking about. It was an old movie,
right.
An old documentary. And, I mean, I was just like, you know, all teary because I'm very optimistic and idealistic, I admit. And I can see this for our future. And I it's very powerful to me, for me. But I know you say that cooperatives are just one tactic, one tool, that there's
right.
other things that we need to explore. Do you want to talk a little bit about those?
Well, I always tell people that as much as I like co-ops, I'm not a cooperativist. I'm a socialist,
mm-hmm. 21st century
style.
And
right. To me, cooperative ownership, 21st century socialism is a mixed economy. Generally speaking, it's going to be part private ownership, part cooperative ownership, and part public ownership. It'll be a mixture of things. And it will probably be that way for some time.
Mm-hmm.
The real question is whether there's workplace democracy and whether, you know, which class sets the direction of government. You know, now we have a kind of dollarocracy or plutocracy. In 21st century socialism, the majority of the people, the working class, would probably set the direction. Although other people would have a voice too, but the predominant voice would be that of the working people. So that's what socialism means to me. And a big chunk of production, and part of this comes out of Catholic social theory, is what's called the subsidiarity principle, which means that you should try to keep decision-making as close to the ground as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And even under socialism, 21st century style, we have markets. And you have local firms, locally controlled, either by communities or municipalities or owned by the workers themselves. And they will compete and compete with other firms, some state firms, some private firms, in a socialist market economy. And in this way, this kind of competition is good. It's not necessarily wasteful. It's sort of like, you know, basketball teams or compete with each other, and everybody learns something in the process.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I think that cooperatives are structurally part of the, you know, the next phase of society. One thing that's good about them is, you know, the way capitalist firms operate is on the principle of expand or die, and also on the principle of maximum return on investment for the shareholders. What that means is a firm can be perfectly profitable and making a perfectly decent product, but if the owners of it think they can speculate on the wage differentials, say, between here and Brazil, they can pick up the factory and move it to Brazil.
Mm-hmm.
Even if it's profitable, because they're speculating on the differences in conditions between the global north and global south. But when you have a worker-owned firm, it doesn't operate under the same pressure. It doesn't have to expand or die. The only thing it has to do is maintain its market share and then a little bit more.
Mm-hmm.
Because even if it doubled its business, and doubled the number of workers that it had and doubled its profits, when you divided those profits among the twice as many profits among twice as many workers, each individual worker still gets the same. So it doesn't have that, it doesn't have that intense pressure to expand.
Yeah.
It has a pressure to improve. In other words, to make work easier, to shorten the working day. So it has pressure to innovate in that sense, in a way that's beneficial to the workers. And it also has no incentive at all to run away, because all the people who own it live in a certain, live in the same area.
Right.
And for the plant to pick up and go away, every single worker, since they're the owners, they would have to agree to move to Brazil too. So business becomes more anchored and more community oriented, and more stakeholders have it, and it allows for democracy to emerge within the workplace. And that's a very important item that, you know, I mean, we have a dollarocracy in the political sphere, but once you punch your time card and go in on the factory floor, you have zero democracy. You can't even whisper the word union in the word in if you're a Walmart worker without getting canned.
That
was one of the things that insights that Father Arizmendi had. One thing he got into a little bit of trouble with the Catholic churches. He raised the question: what is the site of our moral formation as individuals? Where is our moral conscience formed? Well, traditionally, the Catholic Church said that in the family.
Yeah.
The family is the site of, and Arizmendi said, no. The main site of where our moral sensibilities and our moral outlook is formed is not in the family, it's in the workplace. Most of us spend greater chunk of our time, especially at a young and an impressionable age, in the workplace and in under the influence of our fellow workers than we do with a relatively limited next sphere in the family. And in fact, if you have a democratic experience in the workplace, then that tends to spill over and promote more democratic values within the family. So that was a little radical. That was a little radical for, especially in Franco Spain. I think it's a deep insight on his part on the importance of economic democracy.
The products are going to be better because people are happier when they do have a say in the workplace. I mean, it's just a circle. It's all beneficial.
And they manage, you know, when I visited Fagor, this big, huge factory, one thing I noticed when I went in factory, I've been in factories before, I worked in them, and I kept looking around for the foremen. There's hardly any. Because the workers own a share, they manage a lot. There's a lot of self-management. In other words, they have little teams that get together and they discuss it. They don't have to have this whole layer of foremen cracking the whip over top of them. So that means two things. One, it means that life is better for the workers on the line, but it also means financially. It means their firm does not have to pay this whole layer. Of foremen. And so that gives them a huge competitive advantage over the regular capitalist firms that do have to pay for.
Totally, because you've basically done away with the whole tier there.
There's still a few foremen around. I eventually found some. They have some. It's not anything like a U.S. factory at all.
Maybe four also, instead of 25 or something. I mean, you know, definitely.
And same with the wage spread. You know, the average wage spread is from the lowest the new janitor to the head honcho among the managers is 1 to 4.5.
Yeah.
Whereas in the U.S., the average wage spread for a business in the U.S. between the CEO and the janitor is 1 to 350. So that is another huge amount of savings that they can use for the workers themselves to improve their plant and equipment. When you go into modern co-ops, they are not little rinky-dink operations. They are some of the most advanced productive forces in the world, the most modern factories in the world, and they keep pushing to be more and more modern. And the conditions are excellent. The average wage of Mondragon workers in their part of Spain and the Basque Country is 110% of the average in Europe. So they're living better. So what the Mondragon experience does, it shows that it can be done. It's not a theoretical argument. If you say this can't be done, I get into arguments with people sometimes say, oh, this sounds good in theory, but it really can be done. I said, there it is. I said, buy yourself, if you don't believe, you don't have to believe me, buy yourself a plane ticket and go over and take a look or read a bunch of books on it. But, and it's fine. Since the UN has declared this the year of the cooperative.
I was just going to mention that. And I had just recently read that because I had, now it's, admittedly, I don't watch, I throw my TVs out, I don't watch TV and all that, but I do some reading and things, but I had not heard that this year.
Right.
I don't know if it got very much press in this country.
It's starting to. You know, the U.S.
Yeah,
is interesting.
The year is over.
We have a long history of cooperatives in the country going back to the very beginning. In fact, if you drive through in the Midwest, there's many times you come to these little towns and you'll see a huge grain elevator with co-op on the side
exactly.
of it.
Exactly. That's or, where I live.
Where you're seeing a gas station, they'll say co-op on the side. And these were, you know, created by farmers in the populous era and other things as a way to, you know, bring resources to rural America or the power stations. Up until the Second World War, all the plywood produced in the United States was produced by a whole network of worker-owned co-ops in the Pacific Northwest. If you drive throughout the Midwest, you'll run into a supermarket chain called Hy-Vee in Iowa, Minnesota, and Kansas, and Nebraska. There's 25,000 workers involved in hundreds of these. They are entirely worker-owned cooperative. Grocery store distribution setup. I forget how many hundreds of them they have. There's 25,000 workers altogether. Here near Pittsburgh, we had a suburb called Vandergrift, which for about 40 years, not only was the whole town owned by the workers, they owned the steel mill too. Eventually, it went under in the 50s when global competition became too much, but they weren't able to modernize. But they had provided a good living for the workers there for at least 30 years. Then we have ESOPs. Now, ESOPs, employee stock ownership plans, these are a mixed bag. They are not the same as the worker cooperative. Some of them are very similar, but the ESOPs, there's 13,500 ESOPs in the United States, about 12% of the economy. And these are where the stock in the company is held by the workers, but it's held for them by a trust agency that actually exercises control. And if the company does well at the end of the year, the workers will get a check. And if it doesn't, they won't. But they have no real control. On one extreme end, ESOPs are a way that corrupt old owners can get out of certain tax obligations and fleece the workers. On the other end, they can be set up in such a way that the trust encourages worker participation and control, and they're pretty much like Mondragon-type places.
Yeah.
But then there's a huge chunk in the middle that are varying degrees in between. So the ESOPs are kind of a battleground where the struggle for democracy is being fought. And gradually, they are gradually shifting to the left. So that's another huge chunk of the American economy, a pretty sizable chunk, 12%, that's already part of, we could say that's part of the solidarity economy then a solidarity economy exists beyond cooperative students. Things like participatory budgeting. For instance, in the 49th Ward in Chicago, the alderman there, a guy named Joe Moore, every alderman in Chicago gets, you know, so many millions of dollars for their budget for their ward.
Okay.
And so what he's done is he says, okay, we're going to have, instead of me and my staff writing the budget as to how this ward is going to be, how we're going to spend this money, he calls mass meetings of different types on different topics. And hundreds of people come to these meetings. And they debate and discuss how the money will be spent, how the money, they think the money will be best spent for their ward, whether they should spend it on the library or playgrounds or schools or
whether
they
should.
That's wonderful. So that's called participatory budgeting. So that doesn't involve ownership, but it's another aspect of the solidarity economy. The solidarity economy is a much bigger tent than just worker co-ops.
Mm-hmm.
It's all different ways of a popular participation, popular democracy as applied to the economy.
Well, what do you see, say, 10 years down the road?
I see very, very, very intense battles.
Okay.
I always tell people that I like co-ops, and I like all these innovative things people are doing, but I don't think we're going to get to socialism just by multiplying these things like mushrooms after the rain. It's going to be some fierce battles going on, and we can see some of it now. Right now, we have a gridlock, and even despite the election, we say we have this gridlock in the Congress. We have these reactionary Republicans that have to be divided and defeated in order to get anything to move forward. And I have a feeling that capitalism has certain the capitalists can solve their problems to a certain extent. For instance, I could sit down and write up, it's not a big mystery. You know, I could get 10 people in a room and we could sit down and write up a plan to save capitalism from itself for the next 10 years. And the Steelworkers Union already has it written out for them. It's to build the infrastructure of clean energy and green manufacturing, the smart grid, all these sorts of things, and to really spend money on it in a big way, invest money on it in a big way, put people to work, and take away and either tax the burning of carbon or take away the subsidies from the burning of carbon and put it in this direction. And you can get a new lease on life for a while for capitalism.
I believe that. It could last for a while. But it's
for
not
a while. But it can't last forever because it's got built-in contradictions. I learned this when I was at a meeting in Detroit. And at the break time in the meeting, they brought in four or five guys who used to be with the League of Revolutionary Black Workers in Detroit back in the 70s. And they were now older black guys and very smart. They had studied a lot of political theory. And they said they had recently been invited. You know, Obama saved the auto industry in Detroit.
Mm-hmm.
And we all hear about this all the time. And these guys said, well, they, when these plants had reopened, they were invited in to take a tour. They said when they went into these plants, their minds were blown. It was like walking in. They said all of their old jobs were gone.
Oh.
It was all robotics.
Right.
It was like walking into a science fiction set. They said they just couldn't believe it. There were only a handful of workers pumping out all these new cars. So while the auto industry has been saved, and the secondary industries, the parts industries and so on, the spin-offs from them have been brought back, what has happened is you're producing more and more with fewer and fewer workers. So this is a deep systemic problem that capitalism is not going to be able to solve. And that's where, the question of the kind of radical structural reforms that we're talking about come into play. You know, when Obama bailed out GM, he could have done it the way he did. But at the time, my organization, the Committee for Sponsor of Democracy and Socialism, we put out a thing and said, you know, we supported the UAW's demand on this. We said, but there's another way to go about this. You know, he could let the stock status of these companies fall down to penny stock status, buy it all, don't bail them out, buy them out, and then lease them to the UAW and their allies, and then let the workers, one worker, one vote, one share, run each of the factories and hire their, they could hire some of the old managers if they were decent, but hire some new ones if they weren't. And that way you could start on a kind of structural transition. One of the core principles of Mondragon is what they call the sovereignty of labor, where capital is its instrument, which is turning upside down the way a regular factory runs. A regular factory runs, capital is sovereign, and the workers are its instrument. Labor is its instrument. They make it just the other way around. Workers are in charge, and capital is the instrument of the workers. So that is the radical transformation, altering the structures of power that can begin the transition to 21st century socialism. Now, that can happen over time. It can happen in a big way all at once. If there's a huge crisis like we were on the verge of back in 2008, that can happen, very easily happen again. And nobody can really predict, they could get themselves into another war with Iran or something that would be horrible and cause all sorts of things. But
do you have any predictions you'd like to give us before?
The only thing I tell people, hope for the best and prepare for the worst. And that's why I say that, co-ops are one arrow in our quiver. We have to, right now we're engaged in what I call it's not original with me, it comes from Antonio Gramsci, with the liberation and war position. We're accumulating strength. And part of the way we accumulate strength is through our organizations. And we have to build all of them. We have to build, in the economic sphere, we do the solidarity economy, we do worker co-ops, we build trade unions. In the political sphere, we build groups like the Green Party or the Progressive Democrats of America, which is an independent PAC that operates on the left wing of the Democratic Party, or other kinds of community groups and civil rights groups and church groups, and build coalitions among these. And this is builds up a kind of counter-hegemonic power that eventually can get us to a new order. But it's going to take some time and a lot of serious thinking, and probably a lot more than we have time to get into on this show.
Right, because we're going to have to say goodbye. And I really appreciate you coming on. This is Carl Mabelson we've been talking to, Online University of the Left at oulef.org, and Facebook at Solidarity.
She's speaking.
So thank you again. And I hope to have you back, because you have so much to say to us.
Very good. So,
thank you very much.
All right. Good night.
Bye-bye. Have a great weekend.
You too.
In the beginning of September, you'll find DaughtersOfISIS.com fully functional and waiting for you to go on over and make your purchases of any of our oils or our flower essence formulas or misters or powders, potions, and brews, because we've even got teas. That's the ancestor of aromacology over at DaughtersOfISIS.com. Thank you now for coming by to see us. We appreciate it.
And we're back with Michael Clark. Hello, Michael.
Hello.
Hey, I'm glad you made it through.
So am I.
For our listeners, we I have to tell you that we weren't sure if we could get Skype working the way it should be tonight with Michael. And we know that Mercury's in retrograde, so that sometimes messes up communication. But hey, it's all good. So
yep.
Glad to have you here. And he's
glad
in
to be
Mexico.
Here.
We're going to talk about channeled information, angelic readings, all these kind of things. So, I just wanted to ask you when you got interested in channeling, or how?
Oh, when did I get interested in channeling?
Mm-hmm.
it's not really a point of time, really. When I was in high school, I started to use the tarot. And the tarot is, just like they say marijuana is a gateway drug, well, the tarot is a gateway entrance into being able to open your clairvoyant senses. It starts to open you up to not only your higher self, your senses to energy, it also opens yourself up to other levels of being. So when I started to use that, I was unconsciously already touching those levels of other realms. So in high school is when I started.
You just started because you got a tarot deck and you thought you'd just go from there?
Yeah, I just thought I'd start playing around with it.
Yeah,
the strange thing is
that you've... I mean, most of them, so that was a good beginning. Yeah. But then when did you start the angelic reading? How did that come about?
I didn't start that until around 2004, 2005.
Wow.
When I met my wife. Mm-hmm. We started to go to, in Chicago, there's a popular thing called healing circles.
Right.
And we started to go to the healing circles, and I was doing tarot and readings there. And one of my friends from the healing circle said, would you like to read the healing that I'm doing on this person? And I'd never done that before, but I thought, hey, try something new. So I did, and I started to hear and see these images that I'd never seen before. And I heard this wonderful, I wouldn't say it's a voice, because the angels don't speak to me in like voices. They speak to me in the more telepathy kind of way, which is images and emotions.
Mm-hmm.
It's so when I would look at a person that was under a healing, I would see images or symbols representing the things that they were going through or the healing that was taking place. And it was all new to me, but I'm always accepting and open to whatever comes. So I said what I saw. And from that point on, the door was open.
What was it ever, scary?
For me, it's never scary, so to speak. It never comes in a abrupt or a forceful way. So it's always new. I've never had a client or someone that I've read that has ever had the same vision. I've never been given the same vision for different people. It's always different, but it's never scary because I know that they're trying to give me the message that I need to give to the person. They're not trying to scare me. They're not trying. When I channel, I've seen some very from the dark side to the light side, and some of the darker stuff has been, I don't scare easy. So for me to say scary is
uncomfortable, maybe?
Uncomfortable sometimes when it's something I need to tell them, but it's unsure how to say it. Like, I've had to tell people that death is imminent, and that was difficult to say, but not scary to see.
Oh, okay. Death is imminent for them?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, I know a lot of readers, and they all seem to have a bit of a different set of ethics.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not saying that any are right or wrong, but some of them will try to keep certain information or try to couch it in terms that the person's not going to be terrified.
Yeah, I've I've gotten that from many people. Even my wife says I'm very direct. I won't hold back from anything, because if the angels want me to say it, I'm not going to say that, oh, I won't say it. I mean, right. They're the ones that are trying to get the message across. I'm not going to stand in the way of that.
Okay, so that's for, like, you're not giving your interpretation. This is what they're saying. So
this is what they're speaking through, like I said, through vision and emotion. So, and I know exactly what they're saying. So it's not a voice, but it's what they're trying to say through me.
Right. So it's not there's no chance of you misunderstanding.
No. When it's something big, like I said, like a death or something, I'll continually ask them over and over to make sure that I'm getting it right. And they tell me if I'm right on or if I'm way off.
Mm-hmm. Do you have certain, now we've just been saying angels, but would you say that you have a couple, you might call them guides or whatever, you have a couple entities that are your main source of information?
Well, I've always had a clear channel to other sources. I can't say where the angels end and the guides begin, but the angels always have a more loving embrace when the message comes true, and the guides are more cerebral, much more clear energy.
Well, but my question is, I didn't word it well. Like, Esther Hicks has Abraham. Well,
right.
Abraham is a collective.
Right.
Like, going by the name Abraham. So do you have names that your angels or guides go by?
So no, I don't have any specific.
You're always working with Roy.
I'm working.
Or something, you know.
Yeah, I work with multiple different levels of beings. Most of the time, if I'm tired, sometimes the lower energy beings will get through because my defenses aren't up.
Right.
But for the most part, they're there to help. So I give what is best for the person.
Now, do you use some type of, like you were talking about, your defenses could be down or just low if you're tired or if you're starting to get ill or something? Is there a particular thing that you do to protect yourself? You know, I know a lot of people use white light or something along that line. Do you do anything like that before you start chatting?
Well, before a reading, I'll always bring in my guides. I'll cordon off an area that's to be protected against any intrusion. I'll bring in the elements to make sure that they're working towards bringing in the right energies for the reading. And then I'll clear myself so that there's no filter of my ego trying to block what the vision is coming in.
So you cast the circle, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. And is that is whether, do you do readings and things over the phone or?
I've done things on over the phone, in person, Skype, over Facebook. Every so often I'll answer one free question to anyone who asks on Facebook just to keep the knowledge out there.
Right. And yeah, it's always good to give some because you always get so much back.
Well, it's more to the point that sometimes even when I'm not busy, the angels want people to know.
Right.
So even if I'm not comfortable with it, they'll one morning say, now is a good time to make that post.
Okay. So you work with them or you listen to them anyway at any time that they want.
Yeah.
When you want them, then they will come because you recognize them when they want to get through.
Yeah, they're not as forceful as they are with some mediums where they'll in many ways override their life, thankfully. Yes. But
yes, I've heard of that, and that would be very strange and very uncomfortable, I believe.
Yeah, that's rough.
You know, because we are still supposed to be having our own lives too.
Yeah, but I've, those times with those mediums, in many ways, the guides that they have saved their lives on countless times, but it's also uncomfortable because they're such a direction in their life that they really almost feel that they don't have the choice anymore.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So the purely thinking for themselves without checking everything else is maybe a way of path for them. Basically.
Yeah. I'm sure it's very difficult to live that kind of life.
And it'd be hard to be in a relationship with one of them.
Oh, I'm sure, because you
yeah.
can't count on them to, you know, act in a normal way.
Right. It's like, who are you, and am I having my relationship with you or
yeah.
unseen entities? Yeah, that was good. That was scary. Now, because you are dealing with angels and guides, do you think that they are, should we just say, like in a parallel universe, on another vibratory level? And
they're right here with us. They're just at a higher vibrational level.
Okay. And so what about that? That leads me then to ask, you know, so many people I've had experiences with what they consider to be alien beings.
Mm-hmm.
Do you believe that the beings that they've had experiences with are from, like, way out of our universe, from elsewhere and coming here, or are they part of these, a group of the angels and guides that you're dealing with that are here with a different vibration?
Well, the thing with that is that there are some beings that, like I said, are right here, right now, with us on Earth. There are some that are on the other side of the universe, but have such a higher vibrational energy that they can reach across that space, because space really doesn't mean anything. We're all energy. So you can have beings that will visit you and visit me and be channeled beings that are, in a sense, either in this universe millions of light years away or in a whole other dimension and are just reaching across with their consciousness. It's not really a point of, you know, space or time.
So what is, when people talk about disclosure,
they talk about what?
Disclosure?
I didn't hear. Disclosure?
Mm-hmm. Do you think that, do you know what I'm referring to?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm sure he does. Do you think it's going to be any big announcement, or do you think it's just that ordinary people are having these experiences? And so that's the way the disclosure is coming?
I think the way disclosure is happening, and it is happening, mm-hmm. is the only way that it's going to at this point is through...
One-on-one, I mean, basically, that's what it is.
Well, it's happening through movies.
Mm.
It's happening through TV. They're putting it right in front of your eyes, trying to make you, at least on some conscious level, understand what is happening. Because if they did come out in a blatant sense, there would be riots, there would be chaos, there would be mass suicides, there would be so much turmoil that it wouldn't be a benefit to society to pronounce it that way.
Yeah.
And some would like to say that they're trying to scare us, or they're trying to say that, oh, the aliens are going to attack, or they're not. I think it's just saying that they're there. I mean, look at all the news reports now that are actually reporting UFO sightings.
Yeah, that's definitely coming up. It's not, you know, it used to be way back, I'm sure you've read about, what was Betty and Barney? They're that couple way back who lost a couple hours and said, you know, eventually under hypnosis, that they just stopped. And, you know, that was very brave of them to actually allow that to become known, because people just thought they were crazy.
Yeah.
And now it's, you know, if you say, oh, I saw a UFO, well, people don't look at you like you've lost it. They say, yeah, where, you know, and then they start to tell you their tale.
Well, some will still look at you like you've lost.
Oh, okay. Still those, but I do think that there was a time, just like with crop circles, when a couple guys said they made them. I think there was a time when people were claiming to have seen the UFOs. No, and possibly they hadn't. But now it seems like so many credible people are. Yeah. Yeah, we can't really say, well, it's all in their imagination anymore. We can't call them all crazy.
And the thing is, even the reports that are coming out now, you don't have as many, let's say, men in black showing up to your doorstep, because it is so widespread now.
Yeah. So you don't think that there's going to be any announcement by any say a company or a school or a government?
I think there are so many governments now that are releasing UFO documentation and so forth, that I think if an announcement ever does come, which I doubt, but if it does come, it's going to come after a point that the blatant information is already there. Almost like a second hiccup.
Okay, so that nobody's going to be surprised by the time the announcement comes.
Right.
And now a lot of people say that, they give the story of when Columbus came over, you know, I mean, whatever you think about what he brought, but the American Indians who saw him, and when the ships, they first started seeing the ship, they didn't see the ship. But like their chief or something, he was actually a little more, because his mind was more open. He did see the ship. He told them. Then they started seeing, because they trusted him. And this is the story. But it was that they had nothing as reference.
Right.
So they didn't see what their subconscious couldn't latch on to.
Right. Well, that's true with a lot of things nowadays.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I see so much more than my family or my brothers and sisters or anyone else see, because they won't allow that thought or that idea to enter their consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I deal with fairies on a daily basis, and yet most people still think of those as fairy tales.
Mm. I've not daily at all, but I have several times, and I just smile. Now I'm smiling thinking of it. But, yeah. So what would you give as advice if somebody would like to learn a little bit more, or not learn a little bit more, but if they want to open up so that they can learn more or see things?
Well, the first thing, which I call your level one clairvoyance, is to start to really listen to your body's aches and pains. Because that is your body starting to tell you what's in your environment around you. It's all your senses are already there. They're already trying to make you see beyond what you visually only accept. Mm-hmm. And it also has to do with your energetic centers or your chakras. You have seven of them, from the crown all the way down to your pelvis. And your aches and pains to your body are referencing those centers telling you about your environment. so to say, your where your stomach is. That's your third chakra, which represents your boundaries or your personal power. And so say you walk into a room and all of a sudden you have a stomach ache and you're thinking, oh, I shouldn't have eaten that before I came to this party. But you don't realize that when you walked into the room, someone in that room is going to try to test your boundaries. So if you just start to listen to your body and realize that it's trying to tell you about your environment, that will open you up in so many ways to listening more, to understanding more about who you are, the people around you, and who you're really spending your time with.
So, okay, things that people can do. Would you also suggest any type of meditating and this kind of thing?
Well, for me, meditation means whatever makes you feel at peace. For some people, that's laying down and listening to music. For other people, it's mowing the lawn. For other people, it's walks in the forest. But yeah, I do recommend meditation because it brings a sense of peace to your stressful day.
Okay, that. But also, I mean, because you can meditate on a lot of things. So if you're trying to open up, that could be part of the meditation.
Right.
So I know people have different ways. For me, a real good time is right before I go to sleep because it's sort of like the time of year when you're between the worlds. The tails descend. It's very easy to slip into something else at that point.
Right, but the point of meditation, you can do it right before you go to sleep, and after you're done meditating, you'll probably slip right into your sleep. But if you're going to consciously meditate, I'd say do it when you're well rested.
Right, right. If you're going to, yeah. I mean, if you're going to step in, do the whole thing, I agree. That's why many people do it right when they wake up.
Yeah. That's a very good time.
Yeah. I was going to ask also, Ben, when did you start doing the readings? Now, you said that, I mean, right when you first started doing Tarot in high school?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but is this your business?
This is my business, yes.
So how do people get in touch with you?
Well, people here in Mexico just call me, but people that are interested just contact me on Facebook. That's my international, so to speak.
Okay. Reference. Facebook promo page and everything. That's it.
Right.
Michael Fox on Facebook. All right. I just wanted to, let that go. Do you do teachings? I shouldn't say do you do teachings. Do you teach classes?
Yeah, I try to teach. Classes, my largest class has been 2 people. Just because I like to have a more personal contact with the person. I can teach larger groups, but for the most part, the more personal the basis, the more the impact. And that's very important to me. Because the more they personally take the information, the sooner they can start doing it on their own.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Like the old adage about, fishing, you feed someone, you're fed, but if you teach them, they can fish themselves.
Right, take care of themselves. So, no, that's true. I mean, I've been in a lot of classes with lots of people, and it's not that I don't learn something, but it's not the same. You're talking one-on-one, one-on-two, and...
Yeah.
It does make a difference because you just interact totally different. You have no problem getting a question from your students and answering, whereas if you've got, 50 people, it's harder.
One-on-one, the questions are flowing much more easily because they're not judging themselves, thinking, what's the rest of the class going to think about
this
question?
Exactly. Well, they think that I'm stupid. I mean, did he answer that and I didn't get it before? And on and on.
The amazing thing I found in teaching is that most people don't even realize the potential they have within them, just on the energetic side. That they I remember one student asking me, why wasn't I ever aware of all of this before? And I said, because you never believed in it before. Like I was teaching about the elements and how our connection to them. And I said, well, play around with what you can do. And later that day, it was a very cold day and we're walking through the woods. And all of a sudden, this very warm, embracing air comes through. And it stays with us like for 10 minutes. And we thought we were very happy that this warm air was around us. But after a few minutes, it left again. And he had this big smile on his face. And I was looking at him and said, why are you smiling so big? And he said, because I brought that air to us. And I was like, wow, see, if you believe in what you can do and develop it, you can prosper in it.
So you made a believer out of him. Or he made a believer out of himself, just you pointed it out to him.
Yeah, that's the thing. Most people don't allow themselves to believe in what they can do. They always, you know, want someone else to do it for them.
Exactly. Or want them to actually do it, or at least tell them what to do.
Right.
And I know you come across that. As a high priestess, I've come across that a lot, and I've had people get mad at me because I wouldn't tell them what to do, a major decision in their life. And, you know, I don't do that. I won't take responsibility like that. I'm sure they've asked you. And when you're doing readings, they really want to know that type of thing.
Yeah.
How do you do it so that you aren't taking their responsibility away from them?
Well, the angels show me where they'll be at their full potential. They don't tell me how they're going to get there. They just show me where they'll be at their full potential. So when I tell them that, it gives them the idea of where they can start moving towards that end result. On some levels, the vision I get is so outside of what I could see for them that it's also a surprise for me as much as it is for them.
That's good. I mean, you don't want to just always be super blasé about it and say, okay, it's just another day.
Yeah.
It keeps it exciting for you.
Yeah, it's never dull.
You win it and win it. So how long has this been your only work? And I don't mean only in a bad way, but I mean, so you haven't had to do other kinds of work?
Well, I've always done it. Like I said, I started in high school,
but that was the only thing. I mean, that's how you've made your money the whole time.
No, up until 4 years ago. Up until 4 years ago, I've been, you know, working other things. But since then, it's been my major source.
Okay. Yeah. So that's good. I mean, you have to be good, and you have to be somewhat good either at promoting yourself or word of mouth, because you are good.
Well, it's the thing is, you can promote yourself until you're...
You still have to produce.
Right, but the universe is going to send you the people that you need to work with.
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, you can paper your neighborhood, but the people that are supposed to see it are the only ones that are going to see it. So, and I like how down here in Mexico, it's in the States, you have to reference this as entertainment.
Mm-hmm.
And in Mexico, there is a belief that embraces this. It's not for entertainment. It's for advancement in spirit. And some people do it for entertainment, sure.
Yeah.
But they, when they come to me, they realize that maybe it's not entertaining. It's something far encompassing, more than that.
Well, it's a deeper thing. I mean, we think of entertainment usually as pretty shallow. Well,
yeah.
Not always, but usually. And but this is much deeper. This is more on the soul level.
Yeah, I've been told many times that I don't, like I said, I'm very direct. I don't stroke someone's ego. I will answer. I don't have any qualms about asking me about other people, about other things, but I can only answer what the angels will give me. So if it deals with someone else's path, they usually won't even let me see that. But the things that they give me in many ways give them all the answers they wanted before they even asked the questions afterwards.
Okay, but you bring up a good point. If somebody asks you about another person and it's none of their business, and even if the angels say something to you, you would tell them?
Yeah, if the angels give me the information, it means that on some relevant level, they need to know the information.
Mm.
Because, remember, human perceptions and angelic or otherwise see things differently. We have an idea of privacy, an idea of what we are allowed to know, but there are beings out there that see our entire life, and it's not an invasion of privacy. It's that's what they see.
Right. I'm not bothered by anything that they may see. However, the people that I am dealing with, I don't necessarily want them to know my business, and I personally would resent it if one of them went to you and asked questions about me.
Well, see, usually the angels will only allow the information that has relevance in the connection between you and them.
Mm-hmm.
They won't allow a cross after that. Like if they ask, if, say, someone was interested in someone you're going out with.
Mm-hmm.
And they wanted to know how your relationship was. The answer, angels wouldn't answer it because
right.
It has no reference to that person.
Right.
Now, if they asked about how they feel about them, the information is there.
Right. Yeah. And you said that you don't do it ever for entertainment. As far as, I mean, I'm thinking about parties because we've just left the season where I know several readers, and they're good readers, but they will, for money and because they have fun at it too, do like Halloween parties.
Yeah, I'll do anything people want, because it's not about, for me, I mean, the money's great, but it's not about that. It's about getting the message out there. So if people want me to do it for entertainment, I'll do it for entertainment, but the thing is, the message I'm giving, the
message comes through anyway when you're
right.
doing entertainment.
That's and right. that's the thing, is that they may be hiring me to make their guests happy, but
yeah.
the message that they're getting is not an entertainment.
Right, right. Yeah, a friend of mine once said she did a Sweet 16 party.
Mm-hmm.
This woman hired her because her daughter was turning 16 and all her, you know, friends, blah, blah. And she said it was so funny because they all these young girls had the same kinds of questions, and the cards just kept turning up the same answers. It was funny for her. She'd never had that experience before.
Yeah,
but
the cards are always nice.
Yeah, so When you do angelic readings, this is more channeling, and you don't use cards.
No, I won't use cards with the angels. I mean, I can do cards. I'm very good at them, but for the most part, my guides and angels want me to rely on them because, first and foremost, for me, it's easier. It's less energy. The cards take tons of energy because it's not only passing on a message, but it's also about the energy it takes in the interpretation of the cards.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. I mean, that can be pretty stressing, actually.
And for me, not to say that the tarot is important because it helps you understand the complete understanding of a question. It'll cover everything you need to know plus the things you don't.
Right, all the nuances are
right, but it doesn't go beyond that. It can't tell you anything upcoming because now there are card readers out there that use their clairvoyance through the cards to read future events or past events. But that's the reader using their clairvoyance to augment the reading. The cards themselves can only tell you in my idea of the present situation.
Okay.
That's why I charge the same for an angel reading as I do for the cards, but I ask people that, could I give you the angel reading instead because there's more to it and you get more out of it.
Okay, so people, when they just call and say, hey, Michael, I want a reading, they have a choice, but you suggest that they do the angel reading.
Right, and for first-time people, I always say that they must get the angel reading first just because the angels have told me that it's very important for people to get the message. After that, they can, the next time they call or the next time I meet them, they can ask just all questions without the angel reading at all. But I want them to get what the angels want them to hear first.
Now, when people do card readings, usually they have a little a little table set up with the cards and maybe some kind of something else on the table. Do you have anything like that when you do the angel reading?
No. I try to make it as comfortable as possible.
Set up a couch someplace with them and...
Yeah, they'll sit on the couch. I'll sit directly across them in a nice, comfortable chair, and it's more just a conversation of spirit. Other than me casting the circle and protecting the area, and disconnecting them from any negative energies that they're carrying. It's just a comfortable situation. There's no formality, so to speak, to it.
Yeah. And do they ask questions? Like with the cards, sometimes people ask questions at the beginning, or as the reader goes along, they ask questions. Or are they just silent for several minutes while you tell them what the angels want you to, and then you answer questions, or how does that work?
Well, for me, the angel reading is purely them speaking through me and them sitting quietly listening. And then after that, they're allowed three questions. And it can be on anything from past lives, future lives, you know, what have you. There's no barricade to what can be asked because the angels have been with them through their entire existence.
Right. But you do have a limit of three questions so that they don't just start prodding you on every little thing you said.
Well, that's also the thing. I want them to have an idea of what they want to ask because the funny thing is, like I said earlier, they come with a list of questions, but they don't realize is that the angel reading, for the most part, covers all their stresses and worries at the moment.
Right. Yeah, you're going to answer them before you're finished.
Right. So after an angel reading, sometimes people will say, I don't have any more questions. So I always tell them before they come for a reading to think about the questions they're going to ask, because I may, through the angels, answer any relevant questions that they're hanging on at the moment.
Right, because the angels can be picking up what they want to know also. So
yeah.
That's good. How long does an angel reading last?
Well, that's approximately between 20 minutes and 3 hours.
Okay, then, Michael. Okay.
The reason is because sometimes the angel reading is so in-depth and the person, for whatever reason, is blocking what they want to hear, that it takes longer for me to get the message into them. Because I can feel whether they're accepting it or if they're blocking it.
Okay,
and then
sure.
The questions afterwards can be, if the person's going through some pain, it'll take longer for me to make sure that they're receiving the information.
Okay. So now, what then? If you were to say, okay, you're going to schedule a couple of people tomorrow morning. Mm-hmm. You give yourself a couple hours between them, or?
Roughly, usually I don't schedule more than one or two a day.
Okay.
Because I don't know how long it's going to take.
Right.
Per reading.
Right. And you charge the same, whether it's a half hour or 30 or 3 hours?
It's not about... Like I said, it's not about the money.
No, but I mean, this is your time. And one of the things that, you know, it's good to have an exchange.
I know, but for
me... No, I mean, I'm just curious.
For me, it's...
You charge the same.
I charge the same.
Yeah. Well, that's good. I mean, that's... Because they're getting their money's worth because they're getting their answers, whether it takes that long, like 3 hours, or... whether you answer in 30 minutes everything they need.
Right. Yeah. And the thing is, if the reading goes quickly, I may even allow them to ask another question just because I know that I can feel that there's one left in their mind.
Okay. Well, right, because you are sensitive and you notice these things, so that's good. Yeah. Are you tired afterwards?
I used to, in Chicago, I used to go to these gatherings where we would do readings. And after about, I don't know, 10 or 15 readings in a row, I'd start to get a headache. But other than that, it's not really, I don't get, from the angel readings, I don't get tired at all. I actually get
energized,
yeah. The more I do, the better I feel.
10 or 15 at a time. I mean, I know people who work psychic fairs, and
yeah.
They just have no idea who's going to come to them, how many, and they can be, it can go either way for them. Sometimes if they protect themselves well with their energy, they aren't drained, but sometimes they are just exhausted.
Yeah. I mean, after, like, give me a half hour after, like, 15 in a row.
Oh, yeah.
I'll be drained because it's like coming down from a sugar high. It's just
mm-hmm.
a release.
Do you go and wrap salt or whole wheat slice of bread or something?
No.
A lot of people, when they do trance work, they have to ground themselves afterwards.
Yeah. I just, a nice... big glass of water is all I need.
Okay. So this is what you're going to do forever, right? I mean, the rest of your life. You've been doing it for 4 years. You love it. This is your plan.
Well, and if in a month and a half nothing happens, probably, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So what are you expecting to happen in a month and a half?
Well, the changes are already happening. The last month and a half, 2 months, we've been going through energetic cleanse. People have been noticing aches and pains in their bodies and stresses, and now we're getting infused with an expansion energy. And in the next month, it's going to be a roller coaster. I already feel the changes. I am already being told that the changes are happening, that the rest of my life doesn't really mean anything, because in the next month and a half, 2 months, things are going to be so radically different that it won't really matter.
Hmm. Yeah, a lot of people that I know you're working with closely have been experiencing a lot of things. From hearing things, to seeing things,
yeah,
to feeling like we know our DNA is changing. It's very exciting.
Yeah, it's a great time to be here.
Yeah, it is. So, and it's people are noticing who a few years ago, even a couple years ago, wouldn't have had a clue. I mean, they could barely spell spirituality. And now,
yeah,
you know.
And now they're feeling everything.
Yeah, yeah. So it's and you're talking about cleansing, and it's funny because a lot of people are doing a lot of cleansing of their bodies too.
Yeah.
And it's wonderful. It's wonderful to see. So no, it's definitely a good time. So now you mentioned your wife. She does this too, to an extent, or
she's a healer.
Okay.
She, where I work with mostly elemental beings, she works with the higher vibrational beings. So where I get to work with the fairies and the dragons, she gets to work with the extra-dimensional beings, the ETs, and other higher spiritual beings.
So what is your definition then of an ET?
Well, an ET is an extraterrestrial.
Right.
But it's just a being that is like outside of the Earth plane. Whether it be on a dimensional scale, a vibrational scale, or just in a ship above the Earth.
Okay.
I mean, I get to work with all the Earth energies, and she gets to work with all those energies that are above Earth.
Yeah. So together, you've pretty much got it covered.
I guess.
Do you have kids?
No.
No.
All the children of the planet are our kids.
Okay. That's true. So, but yeah, I was just wondering if you were raising children in a certain way. Have you ever written much about what you do or this topic as far as essays, articles, books?
I try, but it just doesn't stick. The for whatever reason, the angels don't whenever I say let's write a book together, all I get is laughter from their side.
Oh.
Because for me, it's not about so to speak attracting an audience. It's about empowering the people that come. So I'm a very good writer, but without my connection, that never really goes anywhere.
But you did give it the old try, or suggested it anyway, huh?
Mm-hmm. I've written little papers and notes and sort of every so often little posts on Facebook. But for the most part, that's about it, as far as it's gone.
Okay. Do you keep a journal by any chance?
No. I try, but for me, journaling just doesn't work.
Okay.
I know for other people, it's the greatest expression of their spirit. But for me, for most people, and this is one of the strange things about me, which even my wife doesn't understand, is that I don't have an inner voice. I don't hear the thousands of voices that everyone else hears in their head all the time. I don't have, it's in my mind, in my body, it's silent. So I don't have a lot to express because I don't hear anything else other than the quietness inside, the crickets, so to speak.
Okay. So you don't have any kind of a conversation with yourself?
No.
Yeah, that is sort of strange.
It's just a nice, quiet afternoon here.
So you think when you're by yourself.
Mm-hmm. But it's the strangest thing. I have to consciously think about something. There's never just thoughts rolling around in my mind.
Okay, it's like, okay, I'm going to think about tomorrow.
Right. I have to think about things.
Well, what do your angels tell you about the way people have been treating other people here, each other, and what they're doing to the planet? Do they talk to you about those type of things?
Yeah, that's one of the big things that I deal with most of my clients all the time, is everyone has and has come here to learn certain things, whether in this life or in multiple lifetimes. And the problem is that everyone wants to take care of everyone else's problems and not deal with their own. So everyone gets caught up in everyone else's dramas and no one ever goes anywhere. So it's like the old saying from the Bible, and I'm paraphrasing, where I'm going to help you with the splinter in your eye and ignore the 2x4 in mine.
Right, the tree in my own, yeah.
So that's the one thing that comes up in almost every angel reading, is that someone has been weighed down by someone else's drama, thinking that they need to help them with it, not realizing that they have chosen to go through that in this life, and all you're doing is taking it away from them learning it.
Well,
and the planet can take care of its own. As much as environmentalists and everyone else says that we're destroying the planet has gone through so much worse than the human race, and it's still here. So as much as our pollution and our wars and everything else is scratching the surface of the planet is showing us through tsunamis and earthquakes and everything else that it's the one in charge, and we're the ones that are scratching on the knob.
Okay, so this is what they tell you when people ask, huh?
Yeah.
Amazing. So, at this point, what kind of advice would you give through them, or just that they have given you many times to give to people about living right now?
Well, let me ask. Okay. They are saying that you have a beautiful life to walk, and it's yours to walk, but you must choose to do it. Don't allow other people to tell you which way you should live it, because it is yours to walk. Live it freely, walk it with strength, and love the path you walk. Everyone has a path that is different, but everyone's path leads to joy.
That's very good advice. We have free will.
Well, to a certain extent, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's always, you know, I say boundaries or something.
Well, the free will we have is not
within a framework.
It's not the direction we go. It's not the things we encounter. It's how we choose to experience it.
Exactly. The whole thing about when you wake up in the morning, you say, wow, I'm going to have a great day. You will. You wake up and say, wow, it's going to be a shitty day. It will be.
Yeah.
You have that kind of control. And what's that something? Oh, it's in that Serenity Prayer, isn't it? God, give me something, whatever, but the strength to know the difference between this and that. So, right, you can make your choices, but be joyous, because joy comes from within. There's,
right.
You know, happiness, sure, you can be happy if you go spend some money, or you can be happy because somebody smiles at you. But that's all that external stuff. The joy comes from within.
That's a reaction. That's not something you have. That's something you're reacting to.
Exactly. But the joy, once you have the joy, it's there.
And yeah, it holds you much farther and much longer.
Yeah. It's a thing. But we're going to have to close. But I wanted to say Michael Clark can be found on Facebook under Michael Clark. And so... actually, if there's probably a lot of Michael Clark, aren't there?
Probably, yeah.
Okay, I will on our Aramarte Peel, I will put your Facebook.
Okay,
my Facebook also, because sometimes when there's so many, people just give up. Now, if there's 50 people with the same name, okay, and I don't even know what the person looks like, so... And a lot of people don't, you know, they have their
their
page is closed and all this. So
they can also find me through Michael's Life Path.
Ah, okay. Should they Google that or is that a page?
That's also a Facebook thing.
Ah, okay. Michael's Life.
LIFEPATH, one word.
Oh, it's one word. Okay, Life Path. Okay. All righty. That will work then. So
great.
Thank you so much for coming in. I'm so glad that we had no communication problem.
Yeah, so am I.
It's like, oh, I know. It's like, okay, cross our fingers and this can work. So Mercury is being good to us tonight. So I hope to have you back on. And you have a wonderful weekend down in beautiful, sunny Mexico.
You too. Thanks so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye.